Well, let's continue with our lecture on the 1920s. One of the things that was very descriptive, or is very descriptive, of the 1920s is that by the time the 1920s roll around, there are more people living in cities than on farms. In fact, a big song at the end of World War I going into the 1920s was a song that was entitled, "How Are You Going to Keep Them Down on the Farm Now That They've Seen Paris?" And that's a good reminder of some things that are changing as a result of the 1920s. The 1920s, like any decade, is a clash of old established values versus newer values that are working themselves into the culture. So, you know, once isolated rural communities with tightly controlled values and high standards of religious morality will be affected by the migration of different peoples into the cities, and thus the migration back to rural areas in some cases. Migration of more people to urban areas changed moral values. This could be seen in the areas of sexual relations and relations between men and women in the workplace, and just generally in religion, just generally what is accepted, what is not accepted. And the 1920s will be an attack on established values. I mean, after all, think about it. What had established values done? What had democracy done? It had got people involved in a war that killed 18 million people worldwide. So, you know, in one sense, nobody wanted to see another war, but also, you know, there was just a challenge to establish values. There's the fast pace of city life that authors and artists will demonstrate during the 1920s. There's the growth of radio. People start to schedule their time around radio shows, soap operas, and radio shows like The Shadow, or on a Saturday night or Sunday night, they'd be watching the Charlie McCarthy show. You know, these are real important things to kind of think about. Three-fourths of everything bought in the 1920s, on average, three out of four things were bought on credit. So one of the things that you want to remember about the 1920s are the installment plans that start to come out. Also, when you're thinking about the 1920s, you're thinking about Henry Ford's assembly line in Detroit. You know, you have Henry Ford's $5 a day wage, which was considered the best wage in America. You have a crackdown on alcohol, okay? And so you have the 18th Amendment that was passed by the Volstead Act in 1919, thereabouts. And it banned the making, selling, and transporting of alcohol. Prohibition did not work. In fact, it created a lot of violence. And you had bootleggers who would meet and race their cars. And whoever had the fastest car, chances are, got the contract to run moonshine to different places. But, you know, this is the beginning of racetracks. Long term, this is the beginning of what we might think of as NASCAR and the Sprint Cup. Along with Prohibition, you had speakeasies and bootleggers. You had John Dillinger as a famous criminal. You had Babyface Nelson. And, you know, when running shine and crime did not work, you had kidnapping cases. And so there were some very famous kidnapping cases. When people needed money, one of the strategies that they would use was to kidnap a famous person and use them for ransom. So bootleggers, you know, running shine, illegal alcohol, is going to lead to the rise of the crime syndicate with Al Capone in Chicago. Ultimately, Al Capone is arrested not for the moonshining, but for tax evasion by a special group of federal officers. In the 1920s, you begin to have G-men, government men. But the G-men were FBI agents who were monitoring not only un-American people, example like the Palmer raids, but also trying to uncover crime and uncover prohibition. Speakeasies were illegal clubs where you could go drink, where you could challenge that prohibition value. And so you would knock on a you would knock and give a special password, like, oh, McGillicuddy, and you could go into the speakeasy. A good example is the basement of the Canyons restaurant as you head into Blowing Rock. The basement of that restaurant was a speakeasy. And think about where that's located if you've ever been there. It's right in a curve. It's easy to get into and out of. So the Canyons restaurant, good example of a speakeasy, just right close to us. A good example of challenging values was the Scopes Monkey Trial. The Scopes Monkey Trial involved fundamentalists like William Jennings Bryan, who had been the 1896 populist candidate for president. And he was a big believer in fundamentalism, big believer in the Bible being literal. And William Jennings Bryan had also been Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State, but he resigned because the United States went to war. And as a fundamentalist, as a pacifist, he did not believe in war, so he resigned. The fundamentalist view of creation will be challenged by a gentleman by the name of Clarence Darrow. He was a substitute teacher, and he'll be using the best science textbook in America. And John Scopes will be approached by the city fathers of Dayton, Tennessee, and they asked him to challenge the Tennessee law banning the teaching of evolution in public schools. And so John Scopes decides to challenge that law. His lawyer will be Clarence Darrow, and Clarence Darrow is probably the leading trial attorney in America at this time. So think about the icons. On the fundamentalist side, you have William Jennings Bryan. On the modernist side, the science side, you have Clarence Darrow defending John Scopes. This is in 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee, in the summer. Eric Larson has written a great book about this called Summer for the Gods, where he breaks down this trial and talks about how it affected American history long term. This trial is reenacted almost every summer still in Dayton, Tennessee. And the highlight of the trial, the big moment of the trial, is when Clarence Darrow puts William Jennings Bryan on the stand and asks him if he believes the creation story. And then he begins to challenge Jennings Bryan on the creation story. In the end, in the Scopes Monkey Trial, as it comes to be called, John Scopes is found guilty. But his case is later thrown out on a technicality. But evolution is still a critical issue in America's schools. And so the Scopes trial is just a great example of these values that are kind of converging. One of the things that we'll explore this week in class is that the 20s culture is a culture of mass media, radio, movies. You know, in the 1920s, you're going to have the first talking film. And Al Jolson, although a white man, will play a black man in blackface. And blackface was a popular movie technique because there aren't a lot of black artists in Hollywood during this time. But you have the radio. Again, we talked about people scheduling their time with the radio. And it will have a huge, powerful influence on the way people think and the way people talk and the way people schedule their time. Newspapers were still important, okay? But the idea of the mass becomes very important. You have jazz during this time. Jazz is the only unique American music, a blend of African rhythms and gospel and the forerunner of the big band era of the 1930s. George Gershwin kind of epitomized jazz during this time with Rhapsody in Blue. And then, of course, Louis Armstrong, the great Satchmo, and Duke Ellington will be a part of jazz music. So jazz tends to show up on your final exam because it's such a unique thing. Along with jazz, African Americans were experiencing a flowering of culture. They called themselves the New Negro, and they wanted more independence, wanted to really see the government pick up the cause of civil rights. And during this time, there are small groups, both in the 20s and 30s, they're banding together, they're working and being more activist to try to make this happen. One of the most popular African Americans during this time is a gentleman by the name of A. Philip Randolph. A. Philip Randolph is or will become head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. These are folks who help you on the train overnight with your luggage and so forth. Langston Hughes is a good example of a writer during the Harlem Renaissance. I love his poetry. He'll write poems such as Theme for English B. He'll write I Too Sing America. And he also writes a series of poems simply called the Jazz Poems. And these are poems designed to be recited to jazz music. So interesting connection between the Harlem Renaissance, a literary and artistic movement, and jazz music itself. Another major player in the Harlem Renaissance is a lady by the name of Zora Neale Hurston. She writes a wonderful book, Her Eyes Were Watching God, and she writes it in dialect. She writes it from the point of view of a young African woman, and it's a great read if you get a chance. So Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, good examples of the Harlem Renaissance, and then, of course, George Gershwin, Duke Ellington, and Louis Armstrong, good examples of particularly the last two, African-American jazz culture. You have the black director and artist Paul Robeson, who is an amazing figure during this time. You have Bessie Smith, who was said to have the greatest voice of this time period. And then, you know, think about it. You have actors and actresses like Charlie Chaplin and Clara Bow and Rudolph Valentino, and again, the first movie was The Jazz Singer with Al Jolson, the first talking film, not the first movie, but the first talking film. Rudolph Valentino would be considered a great artist of his time. The 1920s is a great age of heroes, and the greatest hero of the 1920s himself was Charles Lindbergh. Charles Lindbergh did the first transatlantic flight from New York to Paris in the fall of 1927. Just a major, major accomplishment. You know, he's a mail pilot, and all of a sudden he purchases this plane, adds an extra tank, and, you know, completes the first transatlantic flight from New York to Paris. He flies in his plane, the Spirit of St. Louis, 33 and a half hours. Such an amazing accomplishment. Amelia Earhart will later become the first woman to complete a transatlantic flight, although she goes from New York to Ireland. Some other heroes were, Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth was the hero of the 1920s. And in 1927, Babe Ruth hits 60 home runs in a season. The former pitcher for the Boston Red Sox turned hitter for the New York Yankees. And the Yankees will be a special club in the 1920s and 30s. You have Bobby Jones, who my grandfather was familiar with as a theater owner, because Bobby Jones would be the greatest golfer during this particular time, and later founded Augusta National Golf Course, where they have the big Masters golf tournament every year. You have Jack Dempsey and Gene Tunney for boxing. And boxing and baseball are going to be two really good sports that have the capacity to be carried on radio. Also in culture, you have the literature of the time period. You know, the literature of the 1920s, in a lot of ways, is the literature of escapism. And you have authors kind of smacking up against small-town values. A good example is Sinclair Lewis. Sinclair Lewis, in his best novel, Babbitt, and in another great novel, Main Street, makes fun of small-town life, small-town values. F. Scott Fitzgerald is writing The Great Gatsby, the masterpiece of the 1920s, and it's kind of a cut on the materialistic age during this particular time. You know, some authors were very flattered writing about the materialistic age, talking against it. Other writers looked at the materialism of the 1920s, the escapism, the fact that people were buying things on credit, this buy now, pay later attitude, people trying to get away from the war, and they became a member of the Lost Generation. The Lost Generation were actors and artists and writers who went and lived in Paris. And They just didn't want to stay in America anymore. So remember that the Lost Generation authors are, you know, kind of cutting against, talking out against, being critical against the materialism of the 1920s. Ernest Hemingway, a good example, writes For Whom the Bell Tolls and A Farewell to Arms. Gertrude Stein, T.S. Eliot, the poet who will write The Wasteland, and then Robert Frost in about 1915 had penned that great famous poem, although living in England at the time, but he returned to America and published The Road Not Taken, or The Road Less Traveled, as it sometimes is called. And you're probably familiar with that poem. So these are some folks that are kind of coming of age during this particular time. Remember Lost Generation. Remember the 20s is this great age of heroes. Remember the jazz culture that went along very nicely with the Harlem Renaissance. Remember the icons of jazz, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Bessie Smith, if you're looking for the African-American contributors, or George Gershwin. Another African-American that we need to be sure that we talk about a little bit is Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey, kind of like the Lost Generation, but Marcus Garvey is a black nationalist, and he puts together an idea about purchasing a Black Star Line, a fleet of ships. And part of the black nationalism movement during this time was this idea of moving people back to Africa. You know, African Americans had been somewhat successful with the Great Migration, moving from the sharecropper South to the industrial North. And remember Great Migration for your test. It's very possible that you could see Great Migration. But now here's a different kind of migration, this thought that African Americans could actually move back to Africa, go back to their roots. Marcus Garvey, in a lot of ways, is somewhat of a forerunner of Malcolm X and the black nationalistic movement that'll pick up again after World War II in the 1950s and 60s. So Marcus Garvey helps to form the United Negro Improvement Association, and one of the things that it was targeted to do was to give the opportunity for African Americans to move back to Africa. It doesn't really fully get off the ground, but like I said, it's an idea that'll pick itself up later on. In 1928, Herbert Hoover is elected president. Herbert Hoover is a self-made man. He's a mining engineer. He believes in rugged individualism, about the idea of raising yourself up from your bootstraps and working hard. And a lot of people are very comfortable with Herbert Hoover as president, especially as we move towards what becomes the Great Depression, because Herbert Hoover during World War I had headed up relief for starving people in Belgium and other parts of Europe. So on paper, at least, the man understands relief. He understands the economy, because he had been very economically successful. He comes into office, and the slogan for Hoover, remember Harding's slogan was Return to Normalcy. Hoover's and Coolidge's slogan had been the business of America is business. Excuse me, Hoover's slogan is going to be two chickens in every garage and a chicken in every pot. And essentially what that meant was that, hey, we're going to have prosperity, that prosperity was right around the corner. There had been some hiccups all along the way, that the stock market was not doing well. And by October of 1929, you will have Black Thursday. Black Thursday is the latter part of October, and the stock market is not doing well, and bankers will come in and they will build up the stock market, much like J.P. Morgan had done during the panic of 1907. But that only lasts a few days, because by Tuesday, October 29th, 1929, you're going to have Black Tuesday. And Black Tuesday is the beginning of a massive stock market crash that's going to change everything about the United States, also going to begin the Great Depression that we will not fully get out of till 1942. So imagine 13 years of an economic depression. You know, what will Hoover say? Hoover will say prosperity is right around the corner. Hoover doesn't believe in government helping to get America out of the Depression. He believes it's going to happen almost all by itself as a result of his faith in the business cycle. As the Depression deepens by 1932, Americans will change that phrase, two cars in every garage and a chicken in every pot, and they'll change it to two families in every garage. And that'll be something that gets us to the 1932 election between Herbert Hoover and a younger man who contracted polio at age 28 and who will become the most elected president in American history, even with his physical disability, and that is a gentleman by the name of Franklin Roosevelt. Thank you.